So the third and last oral presentation is an application of cryogenic tanks. Robin Olson.
I'm Robin Olson from Rice Research Institute in Sweden. You see my colleagues, co-authors here, and our study was on the characterization of filament-wound material for cryogenic tanks for liquid hydrogen. So, a lot of the background has already been explained, that hydrogen as a fuel, it has low weight and high density, so that means it's very suitable for fossil-free fuel for aircraft. It has a high energy density, but the problem is that it has a large volume if we don't keep it liquid, and that's why we are focusing on liquid hydrogen storage. Also, carbon fibers, of course, are necessary to obtain a low weight, and thin plies turn out to be necessary to prevent thermal cracking. The challenges are, first of all, we always have a diffusion, and hydrogen molecules are very small. Yannis from Chalmers has already talked about this, and also that we need to prevent the matrix cracking, and that's what we have focused on in this project. Also, the large thermal stresses we get during cooling, the CTE transfers and along the fibers are very different. And if we have to put this into a multi-axial laminate, then of course you get problems with thermal stresses in the laminate. Also, if you involve some metal parts in your tank, then you have the mismatch in CTE between the composite and the tank, and the metal parts. So, one more thing then. We are actually aiming for thin plies because we want to use a linerless design. It's not only about weight, it's about fatigue of the metal liner, for example, as well. And hydrogen embrittlement that you get in metals. So we use the thin ply concept, thin ply theory, and you see that we have two competing failure mechanisms in cracking. One is cracking through the ply, and that actually is independent of the ply thickness. That's what Professor Paris talked about earlier. But you also have the competing cracking along the fibers, and that depends on the ply thickness. And you have to sort of exceed both these stresses in order to get a failure of the ply. So as you see, the thin ply theory tells us that as you decrease the ply thickness, the in-situ strength goes up. And that's because this sort of cracking along the fibers takes over for thin plies. Well, our project it's been a 2-year Swedish project on linerless carbon fiber tanks for liquid hydrogen. It involves a lot of different steps, defining the requirements, selecting the material, specimen manufacture, testing the material to get all the data we need for design, sizing, detailed design, and then we have to manufacture a tank which is actually based on sort of filament winding combined with 3D printing of the end caps in metal, manufacture, assembly, testing, and that's just been completed now, the tank tests. Today I will only talk about the first part, the material characterization, which we need for the manufacture. I should also mention our different partners. Rice are coordinating, Oxion are the material manufacturers, Convigas are tank manufacturer, Chalmers University, Linköping University have been involved in the project as well. And then the main funding is from the Swedish Energy Agency. One more thing which is important is that we do make these tanks by filament winding, which means you actually get a sort of alternating plus minus angle in your laminate by going back and forth during your winding. And what you find out is, if you look on the picture to the right, there a micrograph to, sorry, to the left, then you see that it's not a completely homogeneous structure. We have your bundles, which are thin though, because they are made by Oxyon's materials, but we get, you'd still have some gaps, and you get a fiber volume fraction of about 54%. Then we also want to test the UD material in each of these plies. And then the way we do that is actually an almost UD layup. We do it by filament winding. So we get a plus minus 0.5 degree, for example. And you can see that actually that has an effect on the fiber volume fraction. So why do we do all this? Well, first of all, you see that the plies are not homogeneous. The second thing is that actually the material, we cannot get a data sheet from the material manufacturer. We have to characterize the material as we produce it, because the material properties are a result of the processing. And the aim is to determine the properties of the UD material in each of these plies as a basis for a sort of optimum layup design. We've done tests at various temperatures. We've focused on tensile testing and matrix-dominated properties, because that's the most important for tanks, pressure vessels, cryogenic pressure vessels. We did room temperature tests and some at minus 150 at RISE. But for the tests at 20 Kelvin, minus 253 Celsius, that could only be done, or we at least subcontracted that testing to INTA in Madrid, who have a sort of, they have this kind of a cryostat chamber which could do the tests we needed. Well, if you look at the transverse tensile tests, we see more or less linear behavior. We had some oddities in the at 20K, but I would say this is probably due to icing. It only happened for one specimen. The important thing is that we see that we get an increase of stiffness of about 30% at the cryogenic temperature, but we didn't see an increase in strength. So actually, I would think this is maybe due to a higher defect sensitivity when you get a more brittle material, but we don't really know. We also wanted to characterize the shear behavior. We prefer the Yuzipescu test. We have a sort of improved Yuzipescu rig, where we also use a sort of modified, improved specimen geometry. You see it here. It's a larger notch angle, which actually, as proposed by Neumaster and Melin, is to get a more uniform strain in the specimen gauge section. Also, we did 10-degree off-axis tension tests, not because we wanted to test at room temperature, but it's the only way to do it in our case for 20K. So what you can see here, we can compare the behavior, the response. Also here we use these oblique tabs, which have been suggested by Sun and Chung a long time ago. Well, what we can see is that the modulus is comparable of both test methods, but and I stress strain up to a certain point. But what you see is, of course, a premature failure in your 10-degree off-axis test. And that's because you have superimposed a transverse tensile load on the plies. If we want to compare this 10-degree off-axis test, the effect of temperature, you can see quite interesting that we have a sort of clear nonlinear behavior at room temperature. This almost completely disappeared at 20K. Unfortunately, we were not able to plot shear stress versus shear strain because the fiber optic gauges didn't provide all the data we needed for the shear strain at cryo temperature, but at least this is an indication that the material becomes much more linear at cryo temperature. Also, we see if we plot the transfer strength or versus shear strength here, you can see that actually the shear strength goes up a lot at a cryo temperature. That's blue dots here. We couldn't determine the true shear strength in cryo conditions, but what we can do is that we can actually use the Tsai-Hill criterion and extrapolate the values from 10 degree off axis tests up to the case where you have pure shear. And you can see that we predict the Iosipescu test results almost spot on for room temperature. And this gives us confidence that this sort of increase in shear strength at cryo temperature also appears for a pure shear stress. We also needed the CTE properties at different temperatures. That's immediately required for our design. So we used two different methods. We found out that the mean CTE varies almost linearly between minus 200 degrees and TG. But then below 200, it drops quite drastically. We also measured intralaminar toughness. Actually, we measured interlaminar toughness because in our specimen, when we have this small off-axis angle, we cannot, when we get too much fiber bridging if we try to measure the intralaminar properties. These tests were only done at room temperature, but of course, we would like to also measure this at cryo temperatures. These results were used to estimate the in-situ strength. Well, conclusions for our design was that micromechanics had to be used to correct the material properties for the differences we saw in fiber volume fraction between the UD coupons and the real tank. For our FE simulations or design, we use the sort of average CTE from TG down to the surface temperature for our stress and strain calculations. Here you see the tank is basically a composite cylinder with two titanium 3D printed end caps for simplicity of manufacture. They are bonded together with an adhesive joint to the composite cylinder. These actual bars here, they don't have any function in normal operation. They are more like a safety belt in case that the adhesive joint would fail. That's all.
Thank you very much. So I'm sure we will have several questions.
Maybe not.
Thank you for this very interesting talk. I'm curious about your selection of the 3D printing technology, which is, I guess, powder-based and then involves a sintering step. And these materials, as far as I know, are typically porous a little bit. So how can you stop the hydrogen getting through the porosity of the 3D printed end caps? So are they completely solid after the sintering?
We did some microscopy, and it's not the standard 3D printing technology. It's, I must confess, I'm not an expert in this. So it's some kind of improved method, which is more like welding. So actually, we did microscopy and didn't find any porosity. That's one thing, but the other thing is that our long-term aim is to get rid of these. We don't want to make it we want to make it all composite, but in this project, because of the time and budget, we wanted to get rid of the problems with it. But actually, it turned out it was a big mistake. You get a lot of problems when you have to match two different materials, like composites and metals.
Especially if you go to so low temperature. One very quick other question. How do you actually monitor the diffusion of hydrogen through the wall of the tank? Do you monitor the pressure, or do you detect the hydrogen from the outside? How do you do it?
Yeah, in our case, we detected just pressure and sort of weight loss. But I agree, that should have been done. But I mean, in this case, it's actually a very short time test. And we have used the results by Chalmers as a sort of to back our design. But I would say, of course, that's something you would need to do in a more long-term project. You need to monitor the leakage.
Yeah, thank you very much for the nice talk. So at very low temperatures, the diffusion coefficient should be very low.
That's true.
And so earlier the day, we saw a presentation where about the micro damage and the, how say, leak of the tank and not diffusion controlled leakage. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's why we want to completely suppress the matrix cracking. And it's also been done, supported by some tests at Mohamed Lukil and colleagues at Linköping University. They actually have verified that matrix cracking doesn't really happen in cyclic, temperature loading. So, but of course, it's something we would like to look more into in the real tank, but in the coupons we made, we couldn't see any matrix cracking growth, really.
Just a quick one, Robin. It's true that on the 10 degree of axis, you got transverse tension that leads to premature failure, but with the Iosipescu test, generally you have compressive transverse stresses that come from the inner loading points that have a tendency to delay the onset of shear fracture. Did you check on your DIC data how much transverse strain you had in the middle of your gauge section?
I don't understand how we would get to, I mean, we have an interior pressure. How do we get a pressure? You mean through the thickness?
Compression. No. In the gauge section on the Iosipescu test.
Oh.
You know, you have the two inner loading points, and that creates a path for transverse compression. So there is transverse compression there. The question is to what level, and generally that gives you an apparent shear strength that is higher than the pure shear one. So that's been documented. And I was wondering how, if you checked, because you got your DIC data, so just looking at the transverse strain.
You are talking about the Iosipescu?
Yes, Iosipescu.
All right. Well, we keep track of all the different components of the... don't think in the gauge section that we have much other strains. Outside you have some other, but just in the gauge section I think it's pretty much just shear. But we can discuss it more.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you.